Well, welcome back, Peter. Welcome, Richard. And all continuing. Eno, we've temporarily lost to a bad case of sciatica. Hopefully she'll be back soon. Andrew had a prearranged school appointment he couldn't miss, I think, at this time. It's hard to continue to sit, especially those of us continuing through 7 days. It's a long week with people coming and going, arranging their lives to come and be here. And it's a miracle that we can do it at all. Whatever way we can tap into Sashin is a beautiful offering to all of us and the world. We all want peace, and we all want to open to our true relationship with everyone, kindness and compassion, and due to conceivable and inconceivable conditions, we've been drawn to such a strange path as this one for now. There's some trust, enough trust to be here. And these teachings of the Buddhas and ancestors are admittedly radical. We might wish for something simpler and easier sometimes. And there are, you know, warm-up teachings and practices that are easier to talk about and approach. But in Sashin, the Buddhas and ancestors offer us this radical vision of a different kind of perception, which is the basis of peace and compassion. It seems to me that if we don't start from this basis of empty awareness, vast-like space, if this is not the ground, then it even seems to me that, like, true compassion and complete peace may be impossible. That's maybe a strong statement. The full flourishing of impartial and total openness to all beings, that kind of compassion. And the unshakable peace that can't be lost in the midst of the chaos of the world. I think we need such a radical vision. The ground of the boundless awareness in which everything is included. We need the view of oneness. Without oneness, there's just our usual perception of separation, and we can make the most of it, and we try to make the most of it, but it only goes so far. And it seems to me that from the perspective of this radical vision, that what we might call in modern days scientific materialism, I think if we hold the view that maybe most people in our modern culture hold, that actually this awareness is a product of the body and brain, there's various scientific evidence to support such claims. But I think with such a view, we're lost, we're sunk, where it's impossible to realize the way. With the, I would say, a philosophical view called scientific materialism, that we almost take for granted, because we've heard it from a young age. Not all cultures hear this from a young age, but I really think we almost take it for granted. And I think that it's a view. And as I say, you know, it's kind of backed up by science, but from the point of view of awareness, all of the scientific evidence for awareness being a product of the brain, say, all of this evidence is only appearing to people in their field of awareness. And we overlook that part. We say, no, it's like this. It's like a fact. It's a fact, it's an objective fact outside of our awareness. There's no such thing as an objective fact outside our awareness. So I think to us in with this modern view of scientific materialism, such teachings as all Buddhas and all sentient beings are just one mind outside of which nothing exists, seems almost like fanciful. It's a nice, like, poetic way that the ancestors are talking, but we know, really, that the ground is this body, this brain, and this physical world out of which it comes. So, from our usual view, then we can be like, human beings having occasional spiritual experiences. But I think this is the opposite of reality, which is like, we're actually spiritual beings occasionally having human experiences. In one of our Zen ancestors of our lineage, Dongshan, talking with his Dharma uncle, Mi, walking along, they saw a rabbit jumped across their path, leaped across, was gone. What was that? Amazing how quick that jackrabbit. And and one of them said, swift, so quick. Uncle Mi said, swift, so quick, like a peasant, immediately promoted to emperor. That's how our Zen path is. They use this rabbit leap as a way to kind of comment on their Zen understanding. Our path is so quick, it's like we go from this ignorant human being quickly, suddenly realizing the way and being promoted to emperor in a flash, in the sudden school. Sounded pretty good, but Dongshan said, really? Like, after all these years of practice, you still think like that? And Mi said, well, how would you say it? Dongshan said, after generations, after eons of nobility, temporarily fallen into poverty. Kind of the reverse, right? We might say, not even just after generations, after beginningless Buddhahood, beginningless nobility of unchanging, boundless awareness, clear, free from all suffering and all sense of separation. After beginningless nobility, we've temporarily fallen into the illusion of a human being, poor person struggling. It's not so much that a human is instantly promoted to a Buddha, but Buddha mind is temporarily fallen into a human experience. We've been looking at third ancestors, song of the trusting mind, the Xin Xin Ming. Song, by the way, is just a nice poetic way to translate it, but really Ming, or Japanese Mei, is like more like a stone engraving, like engraved on stone. So we could say it's the trusting mind, like engraved, or trust engraved in the heart or mind, carved in. So even the rain and the storms don't wash it away. It's deeply carved. This trust is deeply carved in the mind. Sanisan, the third ancestor, says, to return to the root is to find the meaning, but to pursue appearances is to miss the source. The root, the source, is this boundless awareness. And to return is this word, ki in Japanese, that means to return, and is also what gets used to translate like saranam gacchami, refuge. They say kie butsu, namu kie butsu. I return to and rely on Buddha. So to return to the root, to take refuge in the root, is to find the true meaning, but to pursue appearances is to miss the source. It doesn't mean that we eliminate appearances of human experience, but to pursue them and get caught up in them is to miss the source. And again, the source doesn't disappear, it's just that we miss it. We're just overlooking it. At the moment of turning the light of awareness around, there's going beyond appearance and emptiness. So, this is the practice. Turn the light around and shine back. So, we have this term, the Zen ancestors loved to just bring up again and again. Ekko Hensho literally means to turn the light, echo, to turn the light, and Hensho is back shining, backward shining, to turn the light around and shine it back, you could say in English. And I love that phrase too, so I kind of like try to research, find all these cases, and just like so many, just this whole lineage of Chinese ancestors and Japanese ancestors used this term, but I'm pretty sure in my, like, you know, digital searches of the canon, that this is the first time that the, it's not the whole Ekko Hensho here, it's just Hensho. Hensho means literally like backward shining, back shining. This light we're talking about, of course, is awareness that seems to be directed outward, and to let it settle back into itself. Being aware of being aware. So it's not the full Ekko Hensho, but maybe the first time in the Chinese canon that this word Hensho is used, at least in the Zen teachings. So at the moment of shining back, the moment of turning the light of awareness around, there's going beyond appearance and emptiness, which is, we might say, going beyond the duality of appearance and emptiness. When we shine back awareness onto itself, there is the empty awareness. Empty in the sense that it has no edges or boundaries. Empty in the sense that we can't get a hold of it as something. We can't grasp it. Empty in that it's empty of all characteristics and fixed reference points. And yet, within this awareness, the entire world appears. It's not that everything stops. It's not that there's no more experiences, but these are now appearances in the field, the boundless field of awareness, or made of. These appearances are made of the awareness, or they are the awareness in the form of appearances. So at the moment of turning the light of awareness around, there's going beyond appearance and emptiness. You could say going beyond the world of things and the empty awareness being two different things. Now we're just resting in awareness, and it includes everything. And this is the realm of non-separation, where we're not really different. Physical, solid people that we like or don't like, and that are doing well or not well, and all of this. Going beyond appearance and emptiness. So then, we have, like, maybe one of the first times Hensho is used. Oh, no, that is the first time Hensho. And another one, maybe just after this was the third ancestor, the sixth ancestor. We have the story that, you know, the head monk chased the sixth ancestor up the mountain to try to bring back the robe and bowl of the fifth ancestor. You all know this classic Zen story. It's the action stories of the Zen ancestors. And the fifth ancestor secretly passed on his robe and bowl at midnight to the sixth ancestor, who was an illiterate layperson woodcutter. And the long time practicing monks were just like, that's crazy, that's insane, it's a mistake, let's get it back. And Wei Ming, one of them, you know, got like a search party of monks, and they're like, we're going to go find him. And they like went up the mountain, and eventually the next day they caught up with him, and they saw, they didn't find the sixth ancestor, but they saw the robe folded up sitting on a rock. And Wei Ming said, finally, here it is. And went to pick it up, but actually it didn't move. He couldn't pick it up. He couldn't pick it up. And at the moment of not being able to pick it up, something like opened in him. Now we could ask, is this some magical power in this robe that like it can't be picked up by those holding opinions, holding dualistic views? Or is it actually just that like he realized that he couldn't pick it up? The rope, it could have been picked up, but he went to pick it up and he's like, actually, I can't pick it up. It's a kind of interesting story. And when realizing, actually, I can't take this, I can't pick this up, his mind kind of opened and he was like, what am I doing? Why did I spend the whole night running up this mountain? Actually, it's sunrise on the mountain. It's a beautiful new day and the birds are starting to sing and actually, I just needed to get out of that stuffy monastery and come up the hilltop and clear my head. Now I'm up here, like, what am I thinking about this robe anyway? And at this time, the sixth ancestor pops out from behind another rock and says, "Hiya!" and Huai Ming says, "I'm so sorry I came up here. Actually, I thought I was coming to steal the robe back, but I was really coming for the Dharma." Very humble now, like, well, you, the one I was like totally angry at and jealous of, can you actually please like help me, teach me something? And the sixth ancestor says to Huai Ming, when you don't think of good or bad, when you just let go of these dualistic thoughts, at such a time, what is your original face? At these words, Huai Ming greatly awoke to the way. When we're not caught up in the appearances, we look back. What is our original face before duality appeared? The conceivable, ineffable suchness of clear, open awareness. So, and then after this awakening of Huai Ming, the sixth ancestor said, what I've just told you is no secret, actually. If you shine back, the secret is in you. So he uses the same word, hensho. If you turn awareness back, the secret is in you. And then we have many other ancestors bring up this phrase, like two generations after the sixth ancestor, Shurto adds in the echo part, the echo hensho. He says, turn the light around and shine it back, then just return. The vast, inconceivable source can't be faced or turned away from. It can't be faced as an object, and it can't be turned away from. It can't be lost, actually. He said, if you want to know the undying person in this grass hut, don't separate from this skin bag here and now. Don't try to eliminate appearances of humans and skin bags and fish and ketchup and aardvarks. And then I didn't even add this one to my list, but I just came across this. It was a nice one, I thought. Later, another Echo Henjo reference from an old journal. This is Da Wei, later Linji lineage ancestor in China. As to this great Zazen instruction, This is his collection of letters. He's writing a letter to a student, and he says, "You say, maybe in your letter, that you have dull faculties. Therefore, you have a hard time practicing." We might sometimes feel like we have dull faculties. You say that you have dull faculties. Well, try to reflect back like this. See if the one who can recognize the dullness is dull also or not. There's an awareness of the dullness. Is that awareness dull or not? Even while I'm dull, is there an awareness that's just always clear and luminous? He says, if you don't turn the light around and shine back, Eko Hensho, you're just keeping to your dull faculties and adding more afflictions. The one who can know that sense faculties are dull is definitely not dull, Dawei says. Yeah? The one who can know that the sense faculties or the mind is actually dull, that one that knows that is definitely not dull. This is, I think, the wind of our Zen house, such teachings. It's not the usual run-of-the-mill Buddha Dharma. It's a unique twist of the light. It's a backward twist, like a Twizzler twizzled in reverse. But then we can taste the licorice flavor for ourselves. To return to the root is to find the meaning, but to pursue appearances is to miss the source. At the moment of turning the light of awareness around, there's going beyond appearance and emptiness. The changes that appear to occur in the empty world we call real only because of ignorance. Ignorance here in Chinese is literally false seeing. False seeing. It's a misperception. That's just like a summary of the whole Dharma, in a way, the sentence, and particularly like Mahayana Dharma, the middle way, is that the changes that appear to occur in the actual empty world we call real only because of ignorance. So there's changes appearing, that's fine, in the empty world. That's the middle way, changes appearing in the empty world. But when we call the changes real, inherently existent, then this is false seeing. Do not search for the truth, only cease to hold opinions or views. So this is a major theme, right, of this song of the trusting mind, not holding opinions. And
is that line right there? Opinion that we should let go of is calling those changes real?
Yeah. And then all the opinions that emerge forth from the reification of things. You could say the root opinion is that things exist in and of themselves. It's kind of an opinion in a way, right? A view or opinion. And then from that root opinion, then we can say, well, because this book really exists here and this book exists here, this I like this one better than this one, and I actually then like, I really, you know, don't try to give me this one instead because this is the better one, and like, you know, then infinite sub-opinions arise from this. But if they're actually just like, appearance is made of awareness, then we can still use them, but it's not like somebody says, well, but you gotta have the bad one instead. I say, well, it's not really like it's worse. They're, in a way, they're all equal. They're equal value, in some, we could say, from the point of view of awareness. Some might be more helpful to waking us up. Yeah, we might enjoy some more than others, but...
Well, I mean, that's right there. Because we always have the function, like you use things or relate things because they have a certain function. So that's the very fact that you recognize them as such is due to the function. Yeah.
Yeah, we, in a way, we attribute some... essence into things based on their function? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, and that's based on our own need of what we think we need.
Yeah, yeah.
The whole thing starts there. I think I need to extend it for a moment, so therefore I need to make it comfortable.
Yeah, yeah. And different things will work for different people that way. I need this. And then we kind of like, yeah, based on that need, we tend to reify it. Maybe there could be a way to be like, I just feel like this is helpful in this situation, but it's without needing to reify it. Maybe very difficult, but we could say maybe that's the realm of like the Buddha's skillful means, when he picks up various things just to help people. He picks up this instead of this, this story instead of that story, but without reifying them. By us.
Yeah.
Yeah. The Buddha is like a response to suffering beings. The Buddha, it says in the Lotus Sutra, all Buddhas appear in the world. There's one, the one great matter of the causes and conditions for Buddhas appearing in the world is just to open beings to Buddhist wisdom and so on.
So I kind of have a story in my head where there's the doll ken, you know, the things for a while.
The what?
The doll ken. You
know, the doll ken,
right?
Yeah.
Right, and there's the one that knows it's not a doll.
Yeah, yeah,
you know, the one who's not a doll is the one that's criticizing the doll one. You see what I'm saying? It's more like the
actually, though, but the one who's not dull, actually, I don't think that one criticizes the dull one. We could say that the not dull one actually never criticizes anything or praises anything. Yeah, so we can, in a way, we can add, I think maybe what you're pointing to is this, is a little nuance of this, of the awareness, is that we can, I don't know if this is it, but this might be a good point to bring up, is that we look back for who is it that's aware of dullness, and then we might think, it's me. This would be one way we might sometimes say that. Who likes this book? I do. It's, in a way, it's like the subject of the object, right? And then I, that's the one that actually likes things and doesn't like things. Me as like the, you know, like ego self. And that one has opinions and stuff. But this awareness is not the same as like the small self. It's not the ego. Yeah. So that's a really important point, that we might look back and actually find maybe even what we might seem at first like it's just the awareness, but it's actually a subtle version of the ego self. In a way, we just have to, again, look back further and say, well, who is giving rise to the sense of a self? So, this is, I think, a nice detail about this turning the light around. It's like, where it seems to be emphasizing objects, like the awareness is directed towards objects, so we turn back and look at the subject. But actually, the subject, in this case, is another kind of object to awareness. It's like big awareness is free of subjects and objects. It's like, that's why it's so slippery, it's so ungraspable. And you could say in this big space, boundless space of awareness, arises the appearance of objects, mainly that's what we notice, but also the appearance of subjects, like me, the thought of like me, Kokyo, the sentient being, the person, is another appearance in this big space. And we could even start examining it like, there's in the big space of awareness, there's the sense of Kokyo as a subject that's actually knowing a book. Or we could even say there's the appearance of an eye, a visual faculty, seeing color. And there's an eye faculty, a color of object, and an eye consciousness. All three of them are appearances in the boundless space. That's why, so even so-called consciousness, vijnana, is a kind of dualistic knowing. You could say, in this big space of awareness, it's not the same as consciousness. Because consciousness is dualistic knowing. But consciousness appears miraculously due to conditions out of this awareness. What conditions? Yeah, what conditions? Well, there's different schools of Buddhism have different stories. So, but one story maybe they could all tell the story that the conditions that consciousness appears out of is like karma, past karmic activity. Well, actually, the 12-fold chain tells one story, right? That's the story. Depending on karmic formations, consciousness arises. That's the early story of how the conditions for the illusion of dualistic consciousness to appear in vast space, aware space. And then a kind of Yogacara version of the story would be like, consciousness arises from this so-called storehouse consciousness, that mental consciousness arises from this storehouse. And we might say, this storehouse sounds kind of like the awareness, but this, yeah, it sounds like a thing, and it's not the same as the awareness. The storehouse consciousness is still a dualistic consciousness, but this is the realm of like complex stories that we best not go into at this such a time. But there's stories for, this is just to bring up, that there are great well-examined stories to explain how out of empty space appearance of people and consciousness and things appear to arise.
That's the same delusion that we're talking about all the time. As soon as any story comes up, it's just a silly story.
Yeah.
The same thing is true about awareness, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, the stories about it are just stories, yeah.
Well, even using that word.
Yeah.
If you start really using it as if you're using something you know something about, that we can, we now have a grasp of something that we can turn around and look at, even just, it's so slippery to me, you know.
Words aren't it, right? I think the second ancestor, after practicing with Bodhidharma for a long time, what was it, Nanyue, one of these ancestors was asked, what is it that thus comes? And all these stories mixed together, right? One of the ancestors, to express his his understanding said, I'm always clearly aware and words don't reach it, or words can't touch it. So you could say, well, that those words, no, they don't touch it, and yet we want to express something. If we don't use any words, then our habitual stories, like scientific materialism, will just rule the day, and we won't question them. So we use words just as tools, knowing that, like you said, it's a very good point, that these words are like limited. They're not, the reality can't ever be captured in the words, and yet that's the whole point of the Dharma, right? It's like words that point to a wordless reality, and you could say an actual different experience of the world. There's Buddhas free from suffering, and there's sentient beings bound up in reified belief, right? So there is a practice and realization. Or, just like, that's the other story I was mixing in there by mistake, it's not that there's no practice and realization, it's just that they can't be defiled by words and ideas. It's tough.
I mean, you know.
Well, it's not easy or difficult, who will later say that.
Clearly there is a practice. Clearly yeah. There is experience, you know, but to start sounding like we have some grasp of what this awareness is and turning or doing anything, you know, what awareness is just nonsense to me. I mean, as soon as it's uttered, you know, I mean.
You might be going a little too far into the side of like, then there's no helpful instructions, there's no skillful means anymore. It sounds like a little far.
I mean, I wouldn't say that.
To say nonsense.
I say nonsense only because you know we can try things and see if they work, but always underlying that the root is the don't know is you know we play around and try to find with what is effective for our lives, but to start going beyond that ever, like he says, if you really look at it, it just goes beyond anything we can ever even hope to understand or grasp. So all we have are these experiments kind of that we do, you know, and if it works better, then that's good. You know, but actually I see us, and maybe I'm just not really quite seeing it, but I see us a lot of times still trying to have some theory that works.
It can never be captured in a theory, but I hear this is not so much theories, but more like practice instructions. And
you know, that you can do.
Yeah, and practice instructions, again, have to be, the raft has to be abandoned on the other shore, right? Or the sticks to light the fire of non-dual awareness have to be thrown into the fire in the end. But if we don't use some sticks, we'll never get the fire going.
No, I agree with that.
The sticks don't have to be this one, right? But that's how it's showing up in today, right? In these particular... Yeah, so I think you bring up a good point that let's not think that we can actually like capture it in a concept or a word. That's really important. And let's not also go into the other, could be another extreme of like, well then let's just not anything we try to do is off track, so let's just sit here. But by sit here, that means that when we're just going to daydream in our usual way.
That's trust in mind. You know, you do it
trust.
Because, you know, just for that reason, you don't just sit there. You trust that we're here, so let's do something and let's find out, you know, how to make this the best possible, you know, experience we can have. But,
and but do what?
Anything. You know, I mean, find out what can I do, you know, explore what is this body and mind and existence capable of.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we know that either, you know.
So we could say these are tools to explore this body and mind.
Well, and yeah. Let's try and find out what it can know or do or see.
Yeah.
You know, only way you can do that is keep testing and probing.
Yeah.
And maybe, mm-hmm. You know, all of a sudden find out you can know things That doesn't matter. I mean, what I'm, the only thing that sometimes I sit and I squirm a little bit, if we think we're talking about awareness and that's something we have some idea about, you know, I don't. You know, I mean.
What do you mean, idea about?
Is there such a thing? Do you think there is such a thing as awareness?
Well, we've already defined that it's completely empty of any reference points or thingness or making it into an object. And yet, in this simple experiment we can do right in any moment, anyone off the street can do, is to just ask, is awareness present right now? I mean, we're using a word, but we can actually look experientially and see something that the reference of this word awareness is pointing towards, a kind of like, what should we say? Reality is maybe a dangerous word, but it's not exactly an experience, but almost like it's like the most obvious, event, or I don't know what word we can say. It's the only thing we might. It's not a thing. It's the only tentative thing that we could say experience. It's the only experience we can verify 100% in every single moment is like there's awareness. It's not some hidden mysterious something. It's like if we can talk
and something.
But it's not hidden.
Right,
it's not hidden.
Something's going on.
Yeah,
but
it's obvious.
From the mystical point of view, that's all we can say. Something's going on.
Yeah. But that attending now to being aware of being aware is not our usual mode of operation, right?
No.
Because we're usually aware of objects.
I agree.
All day long.
Right.
So, but we're not going to find it as something. And if we do, then we just made it into another object. But maybe using the word awareness too much, it starts to sound more and more solidified, and we could choose another one. But just personally,
to shift off every now.
Yeah, yeah.
Like changing our passwords every so often.
That's yeah, yeah.
Exactly what I'm thinking.
Uh huh.
You know, otherwise, it does start to get. If it's used too much, it will be right.
I think that's a good point. So for the rest of the day, I'll try to call it light.
Yeah.
How about that? It's a different flavor.
I just think
it's a more mystical flavor.
This word from this practice mm-hmm. we're talking about.
Well, is it really like transgression that you said a lot of where is that consciousness, aware of consciousness is changing? And I think because it's a consciousness inherently dualistic, awareness is non-dual. So basically, what one can do in order to differentiate between consciousness and awareness can get the viral scanner going. If there is a thought of I am, or any notion of I am, anything that has to do with I am, then that's consciousness, that's dualistic consciousness.
Nice, yeah. Get the virus scanner going.
Sounds silly initially for me, but then I kind of get it, you know, as far as like not being vested in my own self, you know,
yeah.
I am.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's kind of helpful. I mean, you're still playing for real, but I remember being a kid and had my imagination, and it was really creative, and those worlds were really real for me. And it's just right now that it's the same one, it's just this time I believe it. I take it on.
Yeah.
And that's the difference, you know.
Like, yeah.
I don't often remember this.
Totally.
Yeah,
yeah.
So
we're playing a role in the play, and then we start to think that's who we really are.
Yeah.
Totally.
Yeah.
And so that's a great thing, do the virus scan for some sense of I. And just to add to that, the sense of I can get so subtle, right? It's not like, well, it just might be like there's just almost nothing happening, and then we might start like, a feeling or something like yeah, I'm so relaxed and even like blissful and like, this is it. I finally got it. Just this little voice. And like of identification with it. Not a big giant eye, but like a little one that's basically adding something to inconceivable boundlessness. I'm so not here. Yeah, like I can't find any me at all. Yeah, but in Zazen, I think the thought could be very, it doesn't even use the word I, it just might be just a slight sense of something. And then we could apply the practice, the same turning the light around on that is like, well, like, who's aware of that little blip, that little blip on the screen of like, I got it, turn the lighter, like, oh, that's just another dependent arising. So we could say the individual self sense is an appearance, a dependently arisen appearance in boundless space of awareness. And it's just like the first appearance that we reify, maybe we could say, is the sense of like the subject, and then we reify the objects based on me, then there's mine, my world. So therefore, just like all the rest of the appearances, there's no need to eliminate them, and they can't be eliminated, but to see that even the sense of the independent self is a dependently arisen appearance. And we could have stories about that. Where did that one, what are the conditions for that one to arise? That's where I like Darwin's story about that one. Bring Darwin into Buddha Dharma. Say, well, the gene pool of which this particular illusory appearance of an independent self arises, that's the gene pool that survives because they put themselves ahead of others to survive. So it gets more, the genetic dependent arising of this particular illusion becomes more and more seemingly solidified until we just don't even question that it's a reality, that if it's real or not anymore. I think the first, like, amoebas and stuff didn't really get that into it. But, like, at the top of the evolutionary chain of humans, we're, like, way into this one. I mean, this believing in the independent self as actually something more than just a dependently arisen appearance.
So, interesting, I see you want to use something. But I mean, and we've talked about that, you know, but interestingly, it seems like from an evolutionary point of view, it worked.
Yeah, it did, exactly.
You know, but then what do we do with this now? Now that, you know, it's got us here and it did work. It put us in this control seat, you know. But now we're finding out that it's really a deadly...
It's got some problems, too. Yeah. And we could even say, like, dependent co-arising always works, actually. Like, even you could say, the dependent co-arising that's creating climate change and maybe will destroy all life on Earth works perfectly, right?
Absolutely.
It's just that, from a human point of view, it's like, this is a problem.
You're right.
But it's like, it's never... Conditionality, dependent arising, never goes wrong. It's like, it's just following cause and effect, for better or worse.
No, the example that always occurs to me is, you know, oh my God, if human beings had a nuclear war and wiped everything out, you know, well, what would happen would be that some other creature would come along that could use that energy, wouldn't have to use fossil fuels, would have all this beautiful nuclear energy to use. Mm-hmm. You know, and would evolve probably beautifully without having to do, you know, could really balance into that. And so we just set up a condition for some other consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, we gave them all the energy they needed. I don't know. I mean, you know, that's the same kind of thing. If it's only bad for us, it might be great for an animal that can use nuclear, you know, energy that's available, you know.
There's an ancient Zen story of when the whole world system is destroyed due to global warming. Is this destroyed or not? And this meaning boundless, inconceivable, ungraspable awareness, we could say. And one time the Zen teacher said, yes, it goes along with that. And one teacher said, no, it can't be destroyed because it's not something. And therefore, life can arise again. So all this picking and choosing, this is collection of sutras that modern scholars say may be the earliest teachings of Shakyamuni Buddha. Shakyamuni Buddha, our great original teacher, who on December 8th, today on our calendar, realized the great way. Rohatsu means December 8th. And whether it's true or not, these modern scholars say in all these sutras that are all orally transmitted, right, but there's different style of language and different, if you read just the Pali canon we're talking about here, the style is very different in these different Nikayas. And so because of the language style and other clues, I think some say that this is like the so-called earliest version of Buddha's teaching, maybe before all these formulations, even like the Four Noble Truths. We say that's the first sutra that we chant here sometimes, but these scholars say, actually, that came later. This is like the original flavor. And I love that because this section of the Sutta Nipata is part of the Pali Canon. This particular section, they say, is the oldest. It sounds so Zen-like to me. It sounds like the Song of the Trusting Mind. So this sutra is called Paramataka Sutta. Paramata is the ultimate in Pali. Paramartha in Sanskrit. The ultimate sutra. The Buddha says, the person abiding by a certain dogmatic view, considering it is the highest in the world, claims, this is the most excellent, and disparages other views different from that as inferior. As a result, he's not free from disputes. So it's kind of what Richard's talking about, yeah. When he sees personal advantages from the things that he has seen, heard, or cognized, or from rules or rituals, he clings passionately to that alone and sees everything else as inferior. The skilled say that it is a bond to depend on what one associates with and to see everything else as inferior. Therefore, the disciplined one should not trust in things seen, heard, or felt, or in rules and rituals. A disciplined one does not engender dogmatic views in the world, either by knowledge or by rules and rituals. I think he keeps harping on rules and rituals because this is the Brahmin culture that he's talking to. You realize complete purification by just doing these rituals. Therefore, one does not consider oneself superior, inferior, or even equal. No comparisons at all. The sage has abandoned the notion of an independent self and is free from clinging. He does not depend even on knowledge. She does not take sides in the midst of controversy. She has no dogmatic views at all. For him, there is no desire to strive for this or that in this world or the next. He has ceased to associate with dogmas, for he no longer requires the solace that dogmas offer. Whew. To the sage, there is not the slightest prejudiced view holding opinions with regard to things seen, heard, or felt. How can anyone in the world characterize by thought such a pure one who does not dogmatically grasp any view at all? They neither form any particular dogma nor prefer anything. no preferences. Dogmatic views are not esteemed by them. The Brahman is not led by rules and rituals. Thus the steadfast one has gone to the further shore, never more to return. The Sutta Nipata is this collection in the Kudaka Nikaya, the small discourses, which includes like the Dhammapada. They say is also one of the oldest sections. And in the Sutta Nipata here is also the Metta Sutta, which, so that's in the strata of like the oldest teachings of the Buddha too. Sounds a little like the Xin Xin Ming, you know, not so different. And later there was the teaching of right view and wrong view. But here in these earlier teachings, it's like holding no views.
Sounds to me like a bit of the whole notion of you just don't make any effort to survive. You know, how like many things you do is just to survive. Continue to keep us going.
Yeah, kind of like you could say not investing in any appearances. And then we could put a little bodhisattva twist on it and say, I'm not invested in any appearances, but now it's just about benefiting others. What appearance, because we live in the world of appearances, which appearances maybe not to invest in, but which appearances to pick up and use to benefit others. But we've got to be so careful. It's like, pick it up to help others, but then, but I actually really like it too, in a way. Yeah.
So we have to eat, but we don't eat well.
Maybe you don't even have to eat, but probably in the world of appearances, we could say a bodhisattva might eat as a skillful means, because it's like, I think just keeping this body alive so that I can help people with it would be a good thing, so I think I'll eat. But from a maybe a super strict point of view, we might say I'm not even eating for myself anymore. That's pretty like extreme. But Buddha's way is unsurpassable, I vow to become it. It just might be a shift of perspective. It might be that our life, it sounds so extreme, but our life might not look much different. It might look way different, but it might be like, you know, like Tenzin Roshi used to like have this quote many times, and I always wondered why he said this. He'd say, we eat before enlightenment and we eat after enlightenment. But maybe that's what it could mean, is that before we're doing it for me, and afterwards we're doing it just to benefit beings.
And even that is slippery.
It's slippery.
Because benefiting beings are me, you know, so I mean, they're no more real, you know, I mean, so you're really wise, you know, and you have this understanding based on nothing but your sense of your experience nothing. None of those people that are suffering, and their suffering isn't real. But you're going to do something, and that's a very mysterious act. You're going to do it not because it's meritful, not because it feels good, but something in you just harmonizes and says, "Do it." You know, and I think that what you said, you know, what our new practice is that if we develop enough of the right ground, which is all of it, you know, equanimity and non-judgment and so forth, then there is a trust, you know, that will sense what's harmonious and what's right, and we won't really know why, maybe. But we may know, you know, that any sense that we're really doing something that's really important probably is wrong, because we've already concluded that those other people don't exist any more than I do, and neither does their suffering, and it's all going to be okay. But I still, in this play, have to do something.
Yeah.
That's an interesting...
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing? You know,
well, we can see it like like in this play right now, how you could say if we start with the ground of awareness that manifests these different sentient beings, again, it's reversing this the scientific materialist view and saying that first there's just one boundless awareness, ungraspable and inconceivable, and this one awareness takes form as me and you. Therefore, we're completely intimate. We are one mind. And this one mind, I know, in this experience as a sentient being, I really suffer when I grasp things and when even just being hungry or something, right? And even though from a deeper perspective, if I really tap into like the true nature of awareness, it's not such a problem, but I know what that's like, and I'll probably continue to suffer when I forget this too. And therefore we see, then I can see you as another sentient being and see, you're just the same way. You are a manifestation of this boundless awareness. Your true nature is never suffering, but this manifestation, this appearance really does also seem to suffer just like this one does. And therefore we're one being, so we want to relieve all suffering of all our different parts. We're like one being with all these different body parts called me and you. And all sentient beings are the body parts of one mind.
In the play, we do take this stuff seriously. But somewhere back, and we don't know when we decided to have this play, but then once we're in the play, then the play's the thing. You know, then we're going to do it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And we are good actors.
And if there are manifestations of awareness that have gone beyond any reification of the play and therefore no longer suffer anymore, we don't actually have to have compassion for them if they really don't think that they suffer. Those are called Buddhas. They have compassion for us. So, but as long as people are falling for it, we want to relieve it, right? I mean, that's the whole point.
I think that's the play.
Yeah, that's the play. And from the deepest point, we want to relieve it by like awakening everybody to the one mind. But it doesn't discount helping in kind of conventional ways. If a manifestation is hungry, let's feed it. Even, you know, it gets sort of into like pleasant and unpleasant. I might even be in touch with like, I'm really in touch with this awareness and I see that my hunger is an illusion, but I still feel hungry and it is unpleasant. Even a Buddha might have some sense like that. And oh, then we can actually offer a meal to the Buddha and they're like, oh, thank you, that's really... It's not a big deal because it's just an appearance, but actually I really enjoyed that meal. And it's a bodhisattva path. Wow.
That's a good word.
Wow. Nice thing about wow is it's the same forward and reverse. When it's directed outwards toward objects, it's wow. Palindrome. And when it turns around and shines back, it's also wow.
That's supposedly what Steve Jobs said, the best words, right? Supposedly.
Ah.
Wow.
The death poem. Wow. So, dualistic constructs or views do not abide, so be careful not to pursue them. We can let them arise and cease, but pursuing them is kind of like adding a little extra. If there is even a trace of this and that, right and wrong, as truly separate, the mind will be lost in confusion. Although all dualities come from the one, do not be attached even to this one. So that's maybe from our point of view of talking about awareness and the one mind, right? All dualities come from the one, but don't be attached even to this one. This is what Richard is saying, right? If we say it's awareness, if we think it's the word, then that's not it. A monk asked, Zhao Zhou, the myriad things all return to the one. You could say when we're in turning the light around in Zazen, you could say that all the myriad appearances return to the one, are now contained. All the myriad things return to the one. To where does the one return to? And Zhao Zhou said, when I was in Qin province, I sewed this cloth shirt, and it weighed 7 pounds. All things return to the one. Where does the one return to? When I was back in Qin province, I made myself a cloth shirt. It weighed 7 pounds.
That's where it returns to. Sure.
This is the unity of the two truths.
A baby 7 pounds.
Cloth shirt, 7 pounds.
That's a heavy shirt.
It's like thick hemp.
For winter.
Yeah.
Well, that's what he did.
Maybe that's part of the particular image, even, is that there must be something even more empty and non-existent than the one, but actually it's a pretty thick, rough, heavy shirt and has a particular weight on a particular scale. It's 7 pounds. So we might, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. Now the emptiness, what's behind the emptiness? All dharmas. For emptiness itself is form. It's such a beautiful Zen expression of the unity of the two truths in all its maddening particularity. The one must return to some really hidden, far reach of the universe.
No.
Just this cloth shirt. 7 pounds. Do not be attached even to this one. When the one mind is unborn, which it already is, of course. So, since the one mind is unborn, nothing in the world can offend. Or the 10,000 dharmas are not to blame. And when a thing can no longer offend or can't be blamed, it ceases to exist in the old way. When no discriminating thoughts arise, the old mind ceases to exist. So it's nice to bring up this particular human point about blame and offend. I'm sometimes offended by various things. Soho likes to test me sometimes and say something like, I feel offended by that. It's so good for me because then I can be like, well, who actually is offended, right? When the one mind is unborn, or we might say when we're in accord with, in touch with the unborn one mind, then no thing can offend. Still, things can appear to arise, but I think offense is when we actually reify. It's something out there. We reify an other and a self, an independent self that's the offended one. This is really hard, right? But I think that's the medicine for feeling offended.
That's the practice.
Yeah. When we're in touch with the unborn, undying, one mind, no thing in the world can offend. Or another translation says, no thing can be blamed. That's kind of the other side. No subject can be offended and no object can be blamed. This is very practical.
Caring for it and you're trying to
And it's interesting that with a child, then a little kid might start hitting mommy or daddy and saying, "I hate you, I hate you," and the mom and dad might be like that's, it's kind of cute, you know. They don't take it that seriously, but if it's an adult doing that, right, then we take it more seriously. Why is that? Because in the adult world, we kind of like take reification maybe more for granted. When kids are playing and they're like, "This, I'm in a boat now, sitting on a chair or something," we're like, "Oh, that's nice. There, nothing's that serious." But if an adult is sitting in a chair and like, "No, I'm really in a boat now," we're like, "Well, we better like call the police or this is a problem." Parental mind is caring and not taking the children too seriously, overly seriously. Can we sit the rest of the day of Sesshin with our physical and mental pains and like their children hitting us, saying, "I hate you." Okay, okay. It's okay. Yeah, yeah. You can do that. I'm not going to try to stop you from screaming.
Just stay out of the boat.
Take care of all our children. We don't diss their story. Like, well, we don't laugh. "You hate me, but I know that's not real." It's going, okay, one extreme and the other is like, "I really do hate me." And we like negate it or we reify it. Instead, just like the middle way, just receive it. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.